I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome back to Radio Times. Stuart Onan's new novel, West of Sunset, explores the last 3 years of F. Scott Fitzgerald's life. He moved to Hollywood in 1937 to write for MGM and to work on his own stories. Unlike the 1920s, when he and his wife Zelda were the toast of the town, Fitzgerald was struggling financially to support Zelda, who was in a mental hospital, and their daughter Scotty, who was in boarding school. Scott was in poor health and working too much. In Onan's novel, Fitzgerald pals around with Humphrey Bogart, Dorothy Parker, and other Hollywood stars. He falls in love with a gossip columnist while working to keep his family together as he tries to revive his career. Stuart Onan joins us to talk about the F. Scott Fitzgerald he got to know doing research for his novel. This is his 14th novel. I should add that he worked as an engineer before becoming a novelist. He lives in Pittsburgh, the town where he grew up, and as I said, joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. Congratulations on your book, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
How did you become interested in this period of F. Scott Fitzgerald's life?
I was doing research on a nonfiction book that involved Hollywood in the 1920s. And I was reading a nonfiction book about Buster Keaton's work on The General, and it mentioned that Scott Fitzgerald was in town in 1925, and I had no idea he'd been there in 1925. I knew the later Fitzgerald from 37. It also said he'd been there in 31, so I thought, you know, this is a recurring thing in his life. And, of course, he ends up there in 37, and in all the biographies, they say this was kind of, you know, the dark end of his career, the downside, and a waste of his time and his talent. And, of course, I knew vaguely about it, but I hadn't really gone into it too much. So when I started looking in the research of it, I found some stuff, but not really satisfying stuff. Certainly not satisfying the way that fiction is satisfying. They would mention that he and Dorothy Parker worked together at MGM.
Right.
And that's it.
Right.
They worked there. And I wanted the scenes. I wanted to hear them talk to each other. And how do they deal with each other? And so I got sort of fascinated by it and kind of looked further into it and then began to sort of dream up what it must have been like for him.
Were you also interested as a writer yourself? Here's Scott Fitzgerald struggling with himself as a writer.
Not really. I was more into the idea that here is a man who's sort of down on his luck but has this romantic sensibility, and here he is in the most glamorous, successful place in the world, and yet he's $30,000 in debt. You know, his life is sort of, you know, just fallen apart. How does he see this world? He's sort of the ultimate fish out of water.
And the ultimate sort of outsider, which I guess is something he was and in many ways maybe psychologically was through much of his life.
Oh, certainly throughout his whole life. I mean, he's the rich boy from – or
exactly.
the poor boy from the rich neighborhood. You know, he's the scholarship kid at boarding school. He's, you know, the Easterner in the West. He's, you know, the literary writer in Hollywood. So and all those things, the outsiderness and the newness of the place, I thought really would sort of hit his imagination. And I would be working through his sensibility. So it seemed like a great canvas to work with.
Well, I'd love to have you read a section from the book, and this is where your F. Scott Fitzgerald takes a train and arrives in Hollywood.
The train took 3 days, with stops in El Paso, Tucson, and Yuma. He'd sworn off even beer, and the ceaseless drumming and swaying infiltrated him like a sickness. He wrote Scotty and Ober and Max, read and smoked and slept. At breakfast, Palm Springs shimmered like a mirage. After the salt wastes of the desert, the mountains were a welcome respite, the crawling ascent up the grade, then the headlong rush through the dusty ranches and orange groves and garden suburbs with their oaky motor courts and endless rows of stucco bungalows. As they breached the city limits, an eastbound freight blew past, clattering, rocking the car, and then they were racing along the dense, peopled streets of L.A., the horn calling a warning at every crossing. He was searching the skyline for the ivory trophy of City Hall when, abruptly, as if they'd lost power, they slowed and coasted into the switchyard, clanking past the stilled freights and shuttling donkey engines and into the dark shed of the station, slipping by amber caution lights and soot-caked pillars until, with a final grinding squeal, they lurched to a stop. He'd come here twice before as two very different men. The first time, he'd entered the city triumphant, the golden wonderkind and his flapper bride, signing autographs and mugging with Zelda for the cameras as they detrained. The last, after the crash, she was recovering in Montgomery, and he got off at Pasadena to avoid the reporters. Now, as he stepped down onto the platform, there was no one to greet him. He gathered his bags, flagged a cab, and disappeared into traffic.
And that's our guest, Stuart Onan, reading from his new novel called West of Sunset. I really love that description, and it makes me wonder whether you have taken that train. I don't know if it exists anymore, but just the sense of arriving in L.A. at that time.
I'm crazy about trains.
I'm
kind of a train nut.
Oh,
and,
really?
Again, this is a kind of scene that I wanted to write, that I really loved to write, like the scenes of the Garden of Allah. You know, what was it like to live at this garden apartment with Dorothy Parker and Humphrey Bogart and S.J. Perelman, Ogden Nash, Robert Benchley, you know, Tallulah Bankhead comes in. It's just great, great material to work with.
Well, and the Garden of Allah was a place where all these people lived, right? They had apartments was it a hotel or was it a – what was it?
There was a small hotel, but there were also these little villas that were sort of arranged around a swimming pool there, and they would have parties at night, and Bogart and his wife, who were raging alcoholics, would fight with each other. Just wild things would happen there.
Well, as you say, you know, when he first went to Hollywood, he and Zelda entered triumphant, and now he's not exactly sneaking into town, but he's sort of ignored. No one notices that he's there.
Yeah, he's become invisible. From being the highest paid American writer in 1920, now he's deeply, deeply in debt. And, of course, his friend Ernest Hemingway is now the most famous writer in America and the highest paid there. So there's a little bit of shame.
Well, and it seems like there's a little bit of maybe jealousy, competition between those two as you write about them.
Oh, certainly. There's definitely envy there.
You said you were you love trains or you have an interest in trains. Tell us why. I'm curious about that.
I really don't know why. When I was a kid, I just loved trains. I took the trolleys in Pittsburgh all over the place. And later when I lived on Long Island, the LIRR was right in our backyard, and I loved it. I don't know. I don't know why I'm sort of gaga over trains.
Something about the sound or just the sort of what they look like attached to each other?
Everything. I just like all of it there. And I also have this great love for this time period, I think. I mean, this book is set in 1937 through 1940. I have another novel that I wrote years ago that's set in 1943. I have a nonfiction book, The Circus Fire, which is set in 1944. And the new book that I'm working on right now is set in 1946. So for some reason, I'm just attracted to this time period.
But you weren't alive then.
But I wasn't alive then. I love the fiction from that time period. I love the films from that time period. And that, again, that's part of the draw of writing about Hollywood. What is it like to be on the studio lot there at MGM, while they're making The Wizard of Oz, while Selznick is making Gone with the Wind? I mean, to see all this great history that we have a connection to passing before our eyes live right in front of us, that's one reason why I wrote the book.
And did F. Scott Fitzgerald work on Gone with the Wind?
I mean, he did.
This is in your novel.
He did work on Gone with the Wind, which is just crazy. He spent about 2 weeks working with David O. Selznick. And Selznick was famous for staying up all night, hyped up on prescription amphetamines that his doctor gave him, and just working the script over and over and over and driving these writers crazy. Scott was the ninth writer hired to work on this particular script.
And do we know any of his writing still in the film
We're not sure. We're not sure, though it says in some of the biographies and memoirs that he and Sheila tried to sort of reenact the staircase scene between Rhett and Scarlett. Sheila was his girlfriend. Sheila Graham was his girlfriend at the time. So it's possible that he had a hand in that particular exchange, but can't say for sure.
And this is a time during F. Scott Fitzgerald's real life where Zelda is in a mental hospital. She is – or institutionalized.
She's in Highland Hospital in Asheville, North Carolina, where eventually she died in a fire much later. But for some strange reason, the doctors there would allow her to take vacations.
Yeah.
And so Scott would fly back from Hollywood and take her for, say, a week to Virginia Beach or a week to Cuba. And this was supposed to be therapeutic for her. They were always looking for a way to get Zelda healthy enough to go back home and to get out of the institution. And she hated being in the institution because I think she'd been institutionalized for so long that it was wearing her down. It was grinding away her personality. There was less and less of her year after year after year.
You have your F. Scott Fitzgerald say he should have saved her. I mean, I guess the guilt that he felt about her life, her condition?
Yeah, of course, and also leaving her behind. You know, every time that he goes to visit her, of course, he has to leave her behind. And he still feels great responsibility towards her, great devotion towards her. And there's always that nut of, would he have ever divorced Zelda to marry Sheila? And I think the answer is no. He had sort of very, weirdly enough, old-fashioned sensibilities. He was very much a gentleman in a way in his sober moments. And then in his not-so-sober moments, he was just a terrible, terrible human being.
But you see him or you write him as someone who maybe imperfectly was trying to hold his family together, trying to hold himself together during what was obviously a difficult time in his life.
He wants to live up to these responsibilities, which I think had been instilled in him, you know, in his education but also by his father. Mm-hmm. In the sort of the eulogy that he had for his father, he said, you know, what I learned about honor, I learned from my father. Although the father was also a terrible drunk.
There is something about maybe something very American about fresh starts, you know, the idea of starting over. And here's F. Scott Fitzgerald near the end of his life, as it turns out, but wanting a fresh start, wanting to see if he could revive his life and career.
Well, there's that great quote that he uses in The Last Tycoon, which is the book he's working on out there, which is, there are no second acts in American lives. And that's not sort of a declarative statement. That's a question. You know, can we have a second act? You know, can we overcome what we've lost? And that really attracted me to this material. Mm. Not the Fitzgerald who was, you know, the golden boy in the 1920s that we identify with Gatsby and the Jazz Age, but what happens after the crack up? How do you sort of come back after the worst has happened? And I think I look at that question in book after book after book. And in this case, yes, he's a famous figure, but he's starting at absolute zero and he has to figure out, how am I going to live? You know,
did he have a second act? I mean, from the way you think about him?
I think he did. And I think it was he regained himself out there through work. That is, what does he do? How does he make his money? How does he determine who he still is? He's a writer. He's always going to be a writer. He's been a writer now professionally, you know, for 20 years. And so he applies himself and he works. He writes the short stories, the Pat Hobby stories in the mornings, you know, and gets paid peanuts for them. But he's working on them. He's trying to pay the rent with them. He goes to the studio and he works on, you know, the screenplays, which people say was a waste of time. But Margaret Sullavan for Three Comrades wins the Oscar for Best Actress with his dialogue. Vivian Leigh, 2 years later, wins the Oscar for Best Actress with at least some of his dialogue for Gone with the Wind. You know, two Oscars in 3 years.
Yeah.
That's not too shabby. And he works on The Last Tycoon, his unfinished novel, that even though it's unfinished, is widely seen as maybe the best novel ever written about Hollywood. And in rereading The Last Tycoon several times, I think it stands up there with Gatsby and Tender as the Night as some of his very, very best work. So he regains his love of writing. He regains his love of the world. He pays off all of his debts. He pays for Scotty's tuition. He keeps Zelda in the hospital there and pays for that. And he falls in love.
I'm going to pick up on all of that. We have to take a very short break. Stuart Onan is our guest, and we're talking about his 14th novel. It's called West of Sunset, drawn from the life of F. Scott Fitzgerald. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. If you're just joining us, Stuart Onan is our guest. He has a new novel, and it's just been published. It's called West of Sunset. It's a novel based on the last 3 years of F. Scott Fitzgerald's life when he was in Hollywood, working as a screenwriter, also working on some of his own work as well. He died of a heart attack when he was just in his early 40s.
You're giving away the ending there, Marty.
I'm so sorry to do that. But talking with Stuart Onan about some of the research that he did, and I'm also having him read some sections from the book as well. You can join our conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen, and we'd love to have you be part of our conversation. I want to have you read another section from the book. And this is the beginning of a chapter titled The Graveyard of the Atlantic.
As he feared, he didn't get a screen credit for A Yank at Oxford. After a month of story conferences, with no warning, Eddie called him into his office and took him off the picture. The studio wasn't unhappy with his work, Eddie said. They just decided to give another writer a stab at it. Who? He wanted to ask, but there was no sense protesting. They were paying him, and honestly, he'd done everything he could. He took down the headshot of Vivian Lee, slipped it between the pages of his last draft, and filed the script in his bottom drawer. There was no privacy in the iron lung. By lunchtime, everyone knew he'd been reassigned, the writer's table needling him with the brusque camaraderie of a locker room. His replacement was Julian Leighton, a Brit whose farce, Quicker Vicar, had been the rage of the West End 10 years ago. The consensus was that Three Comrades was a better setup anyway. So, Alan said, you've gone from writing for Robert Taylor as a wisecracking vet to Robert Taylor as a wisecracking vet. And Spencer Tracy, Benchley projected like a ring announcer, saluting Tracy at the next table. He's just showing off his range, Dottie said. It doesn't matter what you write for Mankiewicz, Oppy said. He'll make it about the girl. And slap a happy ending on it, Dottie said. Leave him laughing about Hitler, Benchley said. Manx like Jane Austen, Alan said. It could be Hitler, Franco, and Mussolini. In the end, they're all getting married. He's a sucker for the old slow build to a kiss, Oppie said. You would know, Alan said. And a third act reversal, Dottie said. I guarantee he'll ask for one in rewrites. He thinks he invented it. That and the close-up on the phone, Benchley said. It can't just ring. We have to see it physically exists. Better in Selznick with his memos, Oppie said. God, yes, Dottie said. Imagine being his secretary. Imagine being his wife, Benchley said. It has come to my attention that we are spending far too much on wardrobe. Scott laughed along with them, but still, he was disappointed. He wasn't used to having his work dismissed, the long days and weeks of fretful effort he devoted to it wasted, fruitless. He'd come west not just for the money, but to redeem his previous failures here, the scripts he'd believed in rewritten by hacks or ditched entirely. After the last few years, he knew he was lucky to have the chance, and to immediately fall short was disheartening. That the project wasn't his to begin with mitigated it somewhat, or so he told himself. What puzzled him most was that, until this morning, he thought he'd done a decent job.
And Stuart Onan reading from his new novel, West of Sunset. That last paragraph just broke my heart, I have to say. I mean, here's F. Scott Fitzgerald, this heralded writer of the 1920s, getting his work rejected and having the kind of self-doubts that he had.
Writing is about rejection, though.
I figured.
It really is. And I think some of that reaction, that's that Mozart effect. You know, here is a genius who now, many years later, we recognize as a genius, and in his time has been neglected and then dies young.
Yeah.
You know, so that's some of the you know, our heart goes out to Fitzgerald in that sense.
You like the banter back and forth. I enjoyed that. They are, you know, trashing Mankiewicz and Selznick. And I assuming that's what writers would do anyway.
Oh, right? Yeah. And they're so catty. They're so catty. Yeah. Especially the combination of Dorothy Parker and her husband, Alan Gamble. And that when every time they come on stage, they've got some sort of little sort of routine to do.
Also part of this story, and part of the real story, and also part of this story is a woman named Sheila Graham that F. Scott Fitzgerald really falls in love with. She was a gossip columnist at the time.
Yeah, what a person to fall in love with, a gossip columnist.
Yeah, really.
Right? Yeah. And she was – I think Scott was drawn to her not just because she was beautiful, but because of her strength in a way, and the way that she was so unconventional. She was a new kind of woman. The way that Zelda was a new kind of woman in 1919 or 1920, I think Sheila Graham is a new kind of woman for the mid-30s. She's alone. She doesn't need a man in her life. She's very strong. She's a professional. She's very ambitious. And she doesn't take any guff from anybody.
And they live together, right?
No,
do they live together?
No, she was like, you know, I think he always wanted to live with her, and she kept sort of putting him off. She was very much a lone wolf, and I think that drew him to her.
How did he navigate between his feelings for her and for Zelda?
That's what makes him such a great character. He's in a false position. You know, he feels terribly, terribly guilty that he's fallen head over heels in love with this woman. And in The Last Tycoon, which is kind of the romantic clef about his time in Hollywood, his producer, which kind of stands in for him, falls in love with this younger, beautiful, independent English girl. But of course, in that novel, the wife is dead, has already died in the fire. There. So Scott, I think, is in a way is sort of, you know, projecting that into the novel there.
And she wrote a book. The real Sheila Graham wrote a book called Beloved Infidel.
She wrote about five different memoirs about her time with Fitzgerald
and
her time at the Garden of Olive. Yeah, it became a bit of an industry for her. You know, every 8 or 10 years she would write another one. You know,
and were they bestsellers?
Some of them were. Some of them sold very, very well. Beloved Infidel, College of One, The Real F. Scott Fitzgerald, The Garden of Allah. And so she became kind of the storyteller for that time. The wonderful thing about those memoirs is they contradict one another over and over. So she's a very unreliable narrator, as you would expect from a gossip columnist.
Indeed. Was she in love with him, though, do you think? I mean, can we judge that? Can we know that?
I don't think we can judge that so much, but it was definitely a romance. It wasn't sort of strictly lust, you know. It was definitely sort of a very high-flown romance, and I think it revived Fitzgerald in a way. I mean, falling in love for him, I mean, the ultimate romantic.
Sure.
You know, I mean, the world around him changed and became beautiful, and I think it may have helped him get back into sort of the best writing that he did in The Last Tycoon.
I'd like to have you read another section, and this is actually They're Making Love. This is F. Scott Fitzgerald and Sheila Graham. It's on page 76.
Lost in his thoughts, he didn't know what she meant and was overwhelmed when she leaned in close and kissed him. The heat of her mouth surprised him as if it were a trick. She tasted of coffee and peppermint from the restaurant. He hesitated, and she pulled back, laughing. He thought she might be making fun of him, but she opened the door, took his hand, and led him inside, where it was dark. She dropped her keys on a table and kissed him again, pushing her full front against his, and then she was pulling him up a narrow flight of stairs and into her bedroom, the made bed lit by the glow of the city below, and she was relieving him of his jacket and unbuttoning his shirt, and though he wanted to stop her and ask whether this wasn't too sudden, too serious to blunder into, he tugged at the zipper of her dress and watched as she let it drop and stepped out of it, her body backlit, eclipsed. No, she said, when he reached to undo her brassiere. It was her one withholding. She kept it on while they made love, the stiff, padded fabric spectral against her skin, so that even as she was giving herself to him, he felt she was hiding something even dearer. As much as he wanted her, he didn't know her at all. He'd told her his secrets, which she absorbed like a spy, without relinquishing any of her own. He thought it should bother him more, but she was young and warm and lovely, and he was grateful and patient enough, rocking in the dark, to abide this mystery. To Zelda, the girlish Zelda he'd left behind, all he could say was, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry."
And again, Stuart Onan reading from his new book, a novel called West of Sunset. And I found that so interesting that she kept her bra on as a kind of way of only allowing herself to go so far with him.
And,
that was just a great touch on your part.
And she sort of stays in control there, you know. And that's true, I think, throughout the relationship. He wants to have all this abandon of the romantic and to give himself in the moonlight and the dancing and all this. And she's very businesslike. He's very sure. She's a tough cookie.
But the fact that you use that piece of clothing as sort of a representative of that.
Historically true as well.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes.
How do we know that? Just from letters? And
from the research. Yeah, from nonfiction.
At one point she says to F. Scott Fitzgerald in your novel, "I like you better than Hemingway." I thought that was pretty funny, actually.
Yes. Well,
Did she in real life?
Are you better than Hemingway? He says, "I'm a better dancer than Hemingway." Absolutely true. Hemingway's a terrible dancer.
Oh, interesting. You like to do research. I read that about you.
Oh, yeah. Well, I always write sort of away from myself into worlds that I have some curiosity about. Joanna Scott, one of my favorite novelists, says, "Don't write what you know, write what you want to know." You know, and so you get to fulfill your curiosity about a world in a way. You come to it and you say, "I'm totally ignorant. I know nothing about this subject, and I'm willing to learn." And so I end up doing a lot of research in books, in film, video, online. But the best is to find first-person sources.
Right.
And for this particular book, I found just by chance my publicist's grandmother-in-law was a dancer.
Your publicist grandmother-in-law.
My publicist grandmother-in-law.
Okay.
It's a big jump. She was a dancer on the MGM lot in the 30s and 40s and 50s. She married another dancer who became an instructor who worked with Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly and all that. So she told me all the stories of growing up in Culver City in the 20s and 30s and then working on the lot there while Fitzgerald was on the lot.
Wow.
Yeah. So I got lots and lots of great stuff from her.
And I'm assuming correspondence and other other ways that you could sort of flesh out what was happening?
Yeah, yeah. And you sort of fall into it. And then you say, I can't use all of this. I have to be very selective there. And it has to attach somehow to the point of view of your character,
right.
Which, lucky in this case, I have the fish out of water character. So for a little bit, everything's kind of new to him. He's never worked at MGM before, so he has to find his way. And as he's finding his way, the reader finds their way too, you hope.
Did you ever think of this, of putting this in first person? It's written in third person, but did you ever think of having the narrator saying, I?
No. Boy, that is the ultimate trap. Trying to write in Fitzgerald's voice for an entire book, the only person that could do that is Fitzgerald, obviously. It's right. Like saying, I'm going to hit home runs like Babe Ruth. It's like, no, you can't do that. But occasionally I do put in letters of Fitzgerald's and Zelda's and Scotty's as well, which I wrote. To provide a little bit of a relief and a little bit of a change of pace in the prose itself. And it's a little more intimate too, the letter. And plus, the letters were so important to him, having these long-distance relationships with, you know, his wife and his daughter.
Well, I know you're a novelist, so you write fiction, but this period of history and also this place and all these people would also make for a great nonfiction book, wouldn't it?
I think so too, but there are too many gaps. And that's the thing is when I was reading all the nonfiction books, it's like, where are the scenes? I want these scenes. I want these love scenes between Scott and Sheila. I want those vacations that he and Zelda go on. He and Zelda and Scotty, you know, go down to Virginia Beach and spend a weekend and things go bad. I want to be there and see that and feel it as it's happening to my characters. That's why I think fiction can bring you closer to how people feel than nonfiction. I just think fiction has those tools. And I think we've seen the change in nonfiction probably in the last 50 years. Nonfiction has begun to use as many tools as they can of fiction. And sometimes, you know, blurring the line or going over the line. You know, and sort of making things up, which I think is very dangerous. I'm a great believer in objective nonfiction, you know, and subjective fiction.
Have you ever worked as a screenwriter or worked with a group of writers? I'm thinking of that scene that you read where they're all sort of, you know, joshing each other and hanging out together.
Well, I've written – obviously I wrote the collaborative book with Mr. King.
Yes, Stephen King.
About the Red Sox. I also wrote a screenplay about the life of Clara Schumann with Aminet Ansay, the novelist, where we sent, you know, the manuscript back and forth between each other. So we had to sort of give up our ownership of it, you know, our full ownership of it, which is difficult. But and recently I did another story with Mr. King.
Do you call him Mr. King?
Mr. King. Well, I usually, you know, I'll call him Steve. But, you know, I you know, being a great, great fan of his and being kind of a student of his work, I mean, definitely, you know, a little respect there.
Well, indeed. And I know you did write a book together about the Red Sox, and I'm just curious about how you hooked up with him, how that happened.
Well, I know we're both huge Red Sox fans. We both sort of, you know, travel in the same sort of literary circles. And I wrote a novel in 1997 called Dear Stephen King, which, you know, his folks were not thrilled with the title. And so they put a little pressure on Doubleday at the time to take the title off it, and Doubleday kind of folded and did.
What was the problem with the title?
I mean, I guess, you know, his lawyers just didn't want it to be part of the title. You know, everybody wants a piece of him, you know, which I kind of understand. So eventually I retitled the book The Speed Queen there. But in the sort of back and forth about it, I appealed directly to him and said, you know, hey, you know, I'm not a lawyer. You know, I'm just a writer, and this is why I have this. And we sort of began to correspond. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we established that we had a lot of the same loves. You know, Richard Matheson, you know, great, great writer. You know, horror films, George A. Romero and the Red Sox. And, you know, one day when I was just writing, I got a phone call, and it was him.
Wow.
And he said, hey, you know, it's Steve. Do you want to come go to a baseball game? You want to come see the Red Sox? And I was like, yes. Yes, I do. You know, and we got together at the game, and, you know, we had a long-distance relationship. And sometimes when you get together, you don't mesh.
No, exactly. Yes.
And the exact opposite. We were just riffing on each other, you know, all game long, had a great, great time, and just we just kept doing it and kept doing it. And we're such sort of obsessive fans about the Sox that, you know, in 2003 we started this blog with him, myself, and his sons, Owen King and Joe Hill, and we just sort of just wrote about the Red Sox there. And when 2004 rolled around, one of the editors in New York said, how would you like to write a Red Sox book? And I was like, you know, I'll do it, but I'll only do it if I can have Steve work with me. And they were like, well, that would be great.
and you can use Mr. King in the title.
Yeah, then, yeah. Somehow. And it just worked out that way.
Now, you're from Pittsburgh. You're not a Pittsburgh Pirates fan?
I am a Pittsburgh Pirates fan. Born and bred, yes, indeed.
You can do both. You can be a Sox fan.
Well, this is how I became a Red Sox fan. I moved to Boston in 1979, which, of course, is the year the We Are Family Pirates won the World Series and sort of re-sparked my love of baseball. And I lived two blocks from Fenway Park.
Oh, wow.
And it cost $2.
Oh, wow.
And you could smoke in the stands.
Oh, wow.
So I would go smoke in the stands and read my books and, you know, watch the game.
Do you still smoke?
No. No.
It's hard to smoke anymore, isn't it?
Yeah, it's, yeah.
It made it really, really difficult.
One of the best things I did was quitting.
You actually began, I guess, out of college. You studied engineering in college, not writing.
Yeah. My father was an engineer. His father was an engineer. And, you know, I grew up in the 60s, the era of NASA, you know, and the moonshots. And I was just sort of gaga about space and planes. And it seemed natural. And I was very good at math. And so it kind of just a natural thing. And I got a great job at Grumman Aerospace out on Long Island.
What were you doing?
Test engineering. So structural tests. So I was breaking airframes and whole planes. We'd have the entire sort of plane mock-up and have it there, you know, in its fixtures simulating flight. And, yeah, it was a wonderful job. But I was just so much more interested in writing. And reading. And I was just reading and writing all the time. And my wife said, well, you know, look, you don't pay the kids any attention. You don't pay the house any attention. You don't really pay your job that much attention. It seems all you want to do is read and write. So why don't you try to do that for a living? And I was like, that's just crazy. That's nuts. Because I had a good job.
That's really nice,
yeah.
too.
Well, yeah, I was very brave of her. But no, I was making great money, and we had kids. We had a mortgage, and she just encouraged me. And by that time, I'd published some short stories and won a few little prizes here and there, and she thought that I could do it.
Did you think you could do it?
I didn't know. You never – I mean, I still don't know. I sit down – I mean, every day you're capable of writing very badly, every single day. And, you know, it's not the writing badly. It's just the writing. Write something, fix it, make it better. But there's that fear.
Let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Stuart Onan. Excuse me. He is a novelist, and he's got a new book. It's called West of Sunset. In fact, it's his 14th novel, and we're talking a bit about what the book is about, based in part on the life of F. Scott Fitzgerald as he worked in Hollywood, talking more about what it means to be a writer and how he writes. So we're going to take a very short break and then get back to that part of the conversation. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and I've been talking with Stuart Onan about a whole bunch of things, including his new novel, West of Sunset, based in part on the final 3 years of the life of F. Scott Fitzgerald as he worked in Hollywood. We've been talking a bit about Fitzgerald's actual life and how he shows up in this novel, also talking now about how Stuart Onan approaches his own writing. And lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. So was writing hard for you? I mean, for some writer, I know it's hard, but I think for some writers, they can sort of glide into the chair, and it doesn't feel as if their life is at stake. And for others, it does feel like that.
You know, I think in the beginning of a book, when you don't quite know what you have or don't quite believe in it enough, it seems very, very hard. But once you get a sort of a hold of the emotion that sort of, you know, makes the book go and the character mood and direction, if you get that and you get into it and you get a little closer to the character, then it becomes a little more comfortable,
yeah.
I think. I love being in the middle of a book when I sort of – I have something established. I know the character is going somewhere, and I can sort of – every day that character is going to be there, that world is going to be there, and I can sit down in the chair and I find it, you know, fascinating and interesting. But at the beginning, it's really, really hard. Mm. And trying to decide what you want to write, you know, what you want to show the reader, what do you think is important enough to show the reader, that sometimes you can get stuck there. But people ask me about writer's block. They say, you know, oh, you must never get writer's block.
Right, with so many novels,
you've published
right?
so many books. But we get writer's block is what we do. We have it all day long. You don't know what's going to come next. You have to come up with what comes next. And you just have to have that belief that you're going to be able to come up with whatever comes next, that you're not going to write yourself into a corner. Sometimes you do, though,
sure.
and you have to go back or you have to throw it away and start again. And
do you have a voice that, you know, sort of doubts? Questions
oh, of
you
course.
Or doubts you?
Of course, of course. You know, they're not all going to be good. What writer wrote nothing but good books? Nobody. Nobody. You know, even Alice Munro has some clunkers. You know, 95% they're great, you know, and knockouts. But you just keep working and hope that you can run into some good ones. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, how many writers have written, say, four really great novels? Think of an American writer who's written four great novels. Twain, mm-hmm. Faulkner, Roth maybe, Bellow possibly. But you just keep working and you hope you hit something.
But, I mean, how do I put this? I mean, and I'm not a writer, so I understand the process. But I would think that what you want to write is the best novel that's ever been written.
And you do your very best. You do your very best every day. Every day you try to make it as good as possible, and you try to make it better the next day and better the next day, and you try to make it better in revision. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and you listen to editors and you listen to friends and you try to do your very, very best. But you know, some of our greatest writers have written god-awful novels.
Yeah.
There's no guarantee. It's art. It's not like I'm going to make this product and I'm going to make the same thing every time. You're always trying to do something new.
And reading more about you, it seems a character is – I mean certainly, you know, F. Scott Fitzgerald's character in this novel is what the story is about. Is that pretty much true for you in what you write, that it's about a person or people?
It's about, you know, people, whoever they may be, and what's most important to them. You know, the relationships that are closest to them. And think about the people in your own life that you're closest to. Say the three or four people you're close to. You're going to work in those relationships your entire life. And there's always going to be something in them that's not going to be quite as satisfying as it could be. Things you wish that you'd done better. So I'm hoping to try to tell life stories. You know, how well are people doing in their lives and the responsibilities they have towards other people and towards themselves and what they wish they could do better, I think.
Do you have writing rituals? I know a lot of writers, you know, they have like lucky pens and, you know, sort of make sure that by 9 o'clock they're doing this, by 4 o'clock they're doing that. Do you have things like that?
Well, I try to do 9 to 5. I try to treat it like a job because I don't have another job. Right. So I try to say I'm going to give myself 8 hours to get one page double space, and I'm going to try to just move that whatever I'm working on along by one page, little by little, and be patient with it and not try to do things too quickly. Mm. And kind of just, you know, be patient, you know, fall into that sort of, you know, that writer's trance, get the mood of what's happening and try to get that dream going in my mind. John Gardner says that if a character is capable and worthy of love, that the reader will follow them anywhere. I think that's true.
That makes sense.
I think that's true, but I think we've been spoiled and things are so paced so quickly in terms of television now or movies now. The pace is so fast and we see so many fast-paced books or fast-paced short stories that sometimes you need to slow things down. You have to have, you know, the confidence, you know, to slow things down. Dare to be a little bit boring. Mm. There. Not Victorian boring,
right.
But, you know, dare to have a little bit of depth there. So I'm always trying to shoot for some sort of depth and complexity, but also clarity and velocity. I want to keep the reader in there. I want to keep them reading. You know, you don't want the reader to just quit on you.
But it sounds the way you write, and then we'll get some callers in, but the way that you write is that you, as you write, you have a much deeper understanding of your characters, their motivations,
you
who
hope.
They are.
You hope. Right. Now, you hope you're getting close to them. And if you can get close to them, maybe the reader can get close to them and care about them as well.
Mm. Let me get looks like Betsy from Paoli to join our conversation. Hi, Betsy. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, hi.
Hi there.
This is an honor, and I was thinking of Mr. Onan this week because I had a pile of books from the library on my bedside, and I kept trying to read them, and none of them was any good to me. And my first thought was that I wanted to reread A Prayer for the Dying.
Oh, thanks.
Which I think is... It's in my top 10 of books of all time, and I've
oh, wow.
read and reread it. I think it's a perfect book, a perfect novel, and I learn something new every time I read it, and I thank you very much for writing it.
Well, thanks, Betsy. Yeah, that's a weird book. That is a twisted
it
book.
Is.
Yeah, yeah.
Twisted how? Weird how?
Well, I mean, the main character there, Jacob, is really wrestling with himself and with his faith. It's in a weird way, it's an overtly religious book. And yet it's kind of a gothic horror novel as well, and it's written in the second person. And he spirals into a kind of saintly madness in the book. It's kind of inspired by Poe and Cormac McCarthy and George A. Romero's Night of the Living Dead.
Interesting.
It's a weird book.
Is that how you see it, Betsy?
Absolutely, and it's unlike any book I've ever read. And I love the second person. That's not easy. I'm an editor myself. I know that. That's not easy to pull off and keep somebody's attention. It took a while to get used to it the first time I read it. But it keeps my attention the whole way through. And as I said, I learned something more about myself and about people and about small town America in the middle of the 19th century, right after the Civil War. I mean, I've learned so much from it. And
that's great.
Thank you.
And it's short.
And it's short.
Yes.
Betsy, thanks for the call to Radio Time.
Thank you so much.
Thank
you're
you.
Very welcome. I mean, it must be nice to hear stuff like that.
It is. It is. Writers. And that book has some very dedicated followers there. It's actually my wife's favorite book of mine as well.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, but it is a very twisted book. And I always say it wasn't the product of a sane mind. I felt so much better after I was finished writing that particular book.
And was it a kind of crazy period for you?
I guess. I mean, every period is kind of a crazy period for me. I mean, but it's as weird as I've gotten, I think.
Let me get William from Marion on. Go ahead, William.
Hello, how are you? Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
Andrew Turnbull, who, according to him, was the preeminent biographer of F. Scott Fitzgerald, once said at a graduate school class I was in that Fitzgerald went to Hollywood to make money so he could live. Faulkner went to Hollywood to make money so he could go back and write great prose. I was curious what your reaction might be to that statement.
Well, I do think that Scott was hoping he could make enough money so he could carve out time to write The Last Tycoon. And he was able to carve out some time to get at least half of it done. And I think if his health hadn't given out, it would have been a very, very solid book.
Make sense to you, William?
I don't know. I'm more fixed on perhaps the purpose of him going there and his general unhappiness and malaise with never having the final word, which a scriptwriter never gets or a screenwriter never gets.
Mm,
right.
But
versus a novelist or a true documentary kind of writer.
Sure.
But he was also a little bit frustrated in the way that his prose or his fiction had been received ever since Gatsby. And after a while he said, if things just continue like this, I'm just going to go to Hollywood and get into films.
Yes.
So it was always a way out for him. But in this way, I think it was both a way to pay off the debts and to get back to writing.
Yeah.
William,
yeah.
I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Thanks so much. And now we have, looks like Rick from Hocessin, Delaware, to join us. Hi, Rick. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Very interesting conversation.
Thank you.
I met Dr. Vin Baker out of Johns Hopkins, who lived to be almost 102 years old. He was a Rhodes Scholar from my alma mater, UVA. And he was F. Scott Fitzgerald and Zelda's doctor. And also the Duke of Windsor, because he had been over in England and studied. But he always claimed that F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote better when he was in a party mode, that he was drinking some. And when he was dry, he did not seem, and he went in and out of trying sobriety. But Ben said to us, my wife and I, that he knew him, but he always felt better. And he sat in the hospital and observed the ER unit. He used to sit down there and he dried out a number of times. And Zelda was in the hospital in Baltimore trying to deal with her as she became more insane.
Well, Rick,
I just wondered what the author thought.
Yeah, about whether if he was a better writer when he was drinking.
Well, Fitzgerald himself wrote that you could possibly write a short story under the influence of a stimulant, as he said, but not any sort of larger, more sustained work. And so he said that he'd never written at least the better parts of his better novels when he was drinking.
Hmm. Interesting. Rick, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You are working on a novel. I was reading it. It's about the 1946 bombing of Jerusalem's King David Hotel. Do I have that right?
Yeah. I'm working on a novel that's about the era of combined operations with the Haganah, the Irgun, and the Stern Gang, when those three Jewish underground groups banded together to create a revolution against the British Mandate.
Wow. And then what got you interested in that?
Well, the bombing of the King David Hotel has always been a sort of a fascinating moment for me. It's sort of a watershed moment in political violence in the 20th century there. And I don't know. I don't know enough about it. So again, I come from this place of ignorance to say I'm curious about this. I'd like to learn more about it. So to do more research, my wife says I only write the books so I can do the research.
Oh, is that right? That's interesting.
There's a little bit of that. I mean, it's a wonderful job being a writer because you can fulfill your curiosity, all the way to the nth degree.
I'm sure you've been asked this before. Is writing like being an engineer? I mean, having been trained as an engineer, does that help you as a writer?
I think it is very much like being an engineer in that you're always looking for precision. You're always looking for what happens in the real world, not something that's theoretical, but what would actually happen in the real world there. And also the amount of research you do, the legwork, the obsession.
Uh-huh.
I think a lot of engineers are obsessed with their work there. Does it make it better or easier? I don't know about that. I just know that there are a lot of people that have engineering backgrounds who have been pretty good writers. George Saunders was a chemical engineer. Norman Mailer, very different people.
Yeah, very different people.
Norman Mailer was educated as an aeronautical engineer there. Thomas Pynchon worked as a technical writer for Boeing. So that attention to detail, it can go overboard, though, I think.
Did you write in school? I mean, did you show any talent or interest for writing when you were in elementary or high school or even college?
You know, when I was 12 years old, I tried to write a pirate novel. And that's about the only sort of sustained writing that I ever did. But I was always a great, great reader. I just loved to read. I started with comic books. I moved on to sort of adventure novels, science fiction, horror, you know, World War II, nonfiction. Just always, always reading. Still am. Compulsive reader. If I don't have a book, you know, I'm not happy. I got to find a book there. My grandmother said, always bring a book. Which is much easier now, I think, with e-books.
Absolutely.
You know, even though I don't have an e-reader, but, you know, always bring a book.
It's interesting because you live in the place where you grew up. Is that by design or by happy accident? This is Pittsburgh.
A little bit of a happy accident. I left there when I was 18 years old, and I was away for 30 years and lived sort of all over the country. And we were looking for a place, a city to live in. And the children had gone through high school. They were off to college, and so it was just us, and we had this big house. And we're like, why are we living out here in the middle of nowhere?
And where were you living at the time?
Suburban Connecticut.
Okay. Yeah,
truly the middle of nowhere. and we started looking around at cities and what cities were interesting and where could we afford and all that. And Pittsburgh was just so wonderfully affordable. And, you know, it's been coming along for so long. And when we just kind of hit it right at the time when it sort of was just breaking into its own again. And it's like the best move we've ever made.
Wow.
But it's like moving back to almost an entirely new city. You know, because it's changed so much that the demographic of the place has changed. There are young people there now. It's a great, great city. Great people, great city.
Is your house there that you grew up? Is it still there?
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah. Everything's still there.
Everything
is still there. They never tore anything down. People just sort of walked away.
But does that help as a writer? I mean, to sort of be in familiar territory like that, even though it looks so new and different?
You know, I don't know because, I mean, since I've moved to Pittsburgh, I haven't written anything about Pittsburgh. I wrote Emily Alone, which is set in Pittsburgh when I was still living in Connecticut. So I'm not sure. But to be surrounded by memories and to be always sort of prodded to think about other things that have happened in the past, to always sort of be emotionally sort of moved by your surroundings, that can't be bad.
And who's your first reader?
My wife. Yeah, Trudy. Yeah. She'll read it and she'll say, oh, I like that. Or, or this character sort of bugged me or, you know, I couldn't get into it. She's wonderfully honest.
And she's the one that said you should go be a writer.
Yeah,
How great is that?
Yeah, well, you know, she's been very, very supportive. You know, so when she says a book is not, you know, it's okay. When she says it's okay, I'm like, oh, it's so disappointing.
Well, it's been a great pleasure, Stuart Onan. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Mom.
And again, he's got a new book. It's called West of Sunset. It's a novel. It's his 14th. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, Facebook, Twitter, newsletter, and satellite radio. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscow. Thank you so much for joining us.